The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to welcome Jabari Asim back to our stage, albeit a virtual one this time around. The director of the MFA Creative Writing Program at Emerson College, he is the author of the novel Only the Strong, the story collection A Taste of Honey, and several works of nonfiction, including We Can't Breathe, The Art of Survival, and What Obama Means for Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Future. Also a Guggenheim Fellowship-winning poet, playwright, and children's book author, he formerly served as the editor-in-chief of the NAACP's official publication, The Crisis, and was an editor and syndicated columnist at The Washington Post. He joins us tonight with his new novel, Yonder. In it, he tells the story of a group of enslaved Black people seeking love, friendship, and independence in the 19th century United States South. Edward P. Jones, an author whose work I greatly admire, praises Yonder thusly: skillfully wielding a number of literary tools, including a grand way with language, Asim reveals the slaves' everyday world away from the lash and brutality, the loves, the laughter, the age-old tussles with life. Yonder builds a permanent place in a reader's mind. Tonight's author is going to be joined in conversation with Lisa Funderburg. She is the author of Black, White, Other, Biracial Americans Talk About Race and Identity, and Pig Candy, Taking My Father South, Taking My Father Home. A lecturer in creative writing at the University of Pennsylvania and a teacher at the Paris Writers Workshop, her achievements include a nonfiction fellowship from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. Her work has been published in the New York Times, The Nation, Salon, and The Washington Post, among many other places. Her most recent book is Apple Tree, Writers on Their Parents. So without further ado, Jabari, Lisa, thank you so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thank you, Jason. Hi, Jabari.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I'm really happy to be with you here tonight in this virtual space. I'm excited about your book. I just finished it the other day, and I just felt like it cracked along at such a wonderful pace. And it unfolds both because of the propulsion of the narrative of what's going on, but also the way that you've structured it with multiple voices leading us through and layering upon each other. And what I'd like to do is ask you to get us into the right headspace by reading from it. And I can just sort of set the most basic stage, and then you can set the stage for your reading by saying that you've set this in 1852, I think is the year, mm-hmm. in the South, and it's focused on enslaved people whose origins are in Africa, and their attempts to just live and thrive and maintain loving relationships in just awful circumstances. So set us up for what you're going to read and give us a flavor of the book.
Oh, yeah, sure. It would be my pleasure. And Lisa, I'm so glad that you agreed to do this. I was really happy to find out that you were able to do it. So that's really gratifying to me. But I want to thank Jason and Andy Cahan. As Jason mentioned, I've done multiple events at the Philadelphia Free Library. I think this is the first time I've done it virtual, but I've been in person a number of times, and I'm really appreciative of the institution and its audiences. It's always been a good place to visit for me. As for Yonder, like you said, it's set in 1852, and it has multiple narrators, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But one of the challenges in reading from it and events like this one is it's really hard because I don't want to spoil things for the reader who hasn't had a chance to check it out yet. So I've chosen a few passages somewhat carefully, and together it should take maybe 10 minutes or so. So it'll be pretty brief. One of the narrators is a man named Cato. So two of the passages will be narrated by Cato, the first two. And then the last is one of the passages in the book that has an omniscient third person narrator. So, and I'll set that one up when I get to it. Here, Cato is talking about a romance he had with a woman named Iris, and the man who owns the plantation's name is Green, so there'll be references to Green as well. Green allowed us to keep company whenever it didn't inconvenience him. With his permission, I endeavored to make Iris a stool from leftover wood. She had developed a habit of sitting on the humble stoop in front of her cabin at Two Forks and resting on cool evenings. Although I revered the ground she sat upon, I deemed it unworthy of her touch. Nothing cheered me more than seeing her perched on that stool as I approached. At the time, I knew nothing of queens, of royal figures perched regally on thrones. But I knew that my Iris possessed nobility that far surpassed her lowly surroundings. I would sit at her feet, grateful for the simple gift of her attention, until we entered her cabin. Once, when we were reclining comfortably in each other's arms, I asked her to name her favorite color. "Whatever color you are," she said. "Iris, tell me your favorite color. Describe it to me." "I'd say you're about the same as polished walnut. I saw you rubbing that stool you'd made me. You insisted on making it gleam before I could sit down on it. I remember you with that cloth, rubbing. I couldn't tell where your hand ended and the wood began. Polished walnut. Iris, just tell me." She rolled over and faced me. "Cato, you're my favorite, and that's as far as I go with it. Declaring my fondness for things means I got to feel the hurt when they're taken away. Nothing good lasts. I'm going to last," I told her. "I swear it on my seven words." "Good," she said, grinning again. "The only thing I've let my heart linger on is you." That wasn't completely true. She kept mementos of the people she'd lost, a patch of straw from an old hat, a yank of hair from a baby who had been sold. She kept those things in a pouch hanging from a cowhide string around her waist, as was the habit of many stolen women. She never talked much about her departed loves, but I knew they lived in her heart too. After we lay together for the first time, she put stray locks from my beard into her pouch. I found myself grateful that she had made room for me. Nestled against her, I learned more about the two children she'd born and lost, about the straw hat her mother took off her head and handed to her before new thieves yanked her away, how Iris wore it until the sun burned through its tattered fringe. Her stammers and pauses showed me how hard it was for her to talk about the people she loved and who had loved her. They remained mostly a part of her private self. So the second section, Cato has undergone an ordeal in which he has been punished for transgressions he has committed. Rain had been falling for hours. Perhaps fall is too gentle a word. It was the kind of downpour that leaves scars, grooves, and dents in the earth. I shivered in my chains, blinking rapidly as it came down in sheets and pellets. With Silent Mary's broth coursing through my innards, I had regained sufficient strength to hold myself in a sitting position, resting my head against the post. I had only to be alive until daybreak, and Green would remove my chains, leaving me bound to him nonetheless. Soaked to the bone, I awaited the dawn while considering the looming paradox of my situation, what little I had to live for. In the distance, the splintered gray boards of our cabins appeared to tremble and dissolve in the wet. The resulting cloud of grayness, murky and unsettled, gradually took on new shapes, outlines of boys and girls. Struck dumb, I watched while they marched down the corridor of the quarters toward me before veering sharply and proceeding toward the plantation borders. Clad in garments I had never seen, nothing like our sackcloth and threadbare cast-offs, they passed me in shades of gray, nearly close enough to touch. I had thought of my ancestors as ancient, with a history of torment etched on their weathered faces. But these were children, ranging in age from five harvests to 15, with gleaming faces and vigorous frames. I didn't understand their youthfulness. I understood only that they had been in the world before I came to it, and that they now belonged to some other place. Occasionally, a boy or girl would pause and look at me, then rejoin the procession without missing a step. They walked unsullied through the mud, as smoothly as if they were gliding on cushions of air. I called to them, but any sound I made was lost in the fury of the gale. Okay, this last passage, as I mentioned, this is an omniscient third person passage. It's about a character named Sarah, who is being transported from one plantation to another by an overseer named Holdsclaw, whom she knows to be a bad man. Having helped himself to Silent Mary's baked goods without offering Sarah so much as a nibble, Holdsclaw deduced that he had been perhaps too hasty in his consumption. Midpoint between Placid Hall and Two Forks, his stomach had grown angry and demanded relief. He halted the wagon at the side of a tree-lined road, climbed down, and hurried into a thicket of vines. Sarah could see the top of his head as he squatted and grunted. She could also see a rock, substantial yet handy, on the ground between him and the wagon. She studied it, imagining what she could do with it and calculating the speed and stealth she'd need to cover the distance. Slowly, quietly, she swung her legs over the side of the wagon. Before she could lower her feet to the ground, a flicker of motion in the trees above her head made her pause. She looked up and saw, crouching on a branch, a creature from another world. It rested on one haunch, the other leg fully extended along the length of the branch, with both arms stretched upward and grasping an overhead limb. The being's clothes were made to resemble bark, enabling it to blend almost seamlessly against its background. Most striking was its face, in broad strokes of brown and green, painted so closely together that no flesh showed. Was it a haint? An angel? Sarah was too awestruck to hazard a guess. Without losing balance, the creature folded an elegant arm and placed a finger to its lips. Sarah nearly gasped when the creature leaped and landed gracefully on silent feet. It squatted and, securing Sarah's attention, drew in the dirt with its index finger. After making sure Sarah saw the marks it made, it rubbed them away. Quick as death, it scampered up a tree and returned to its perch. His bowels settled, Holdsclaw came back to the wagon and noticed a glow on Sarah's face. He chuckled to himself, concluding that her radiance was a sign of the excitement he assumed he aroused in Stolen Wenches. Sarah lived to experience even more surprises, but none as wondrous as her encounter with the mystical figure that swooped down from the trees. She knew then that she would always remember the angel's marks in the dirt, even if she never learned to make sense of them. The cryptic letters burned in her memory as if they had been written in flames. In due time, the words read. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Jabari. Oh, that was so rich. And it just stirs up so many of the fundamental joys of the novel, including the variety of voices. And then also, I don't know if joy is a good word, but just the power of the juxtaposition of people trying to live their lives and evil around them.
Sure. Yeah.
The closeness of sort of reality and magic, of certainty and ambiguity. I wanted to just start by asking you about the inspiration for this book. And I'm sure you could answer that a bunch of different ways, but yeah. I hope you will include the story of George Washington's.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Because as you know, Lisa, my depending on the day you ask me, the answer can be different. So a couple of things I want to be sure to mention is one was the real life story of William Lee, who was enslaved by George Washington and who was in love with the free Black woman named Margaret Thomas. And so two of my characters are named William and Margaret. They are not based on those historical figures, but that's definitely where I got their names. So William Lee served beside George Washington during the Revolutionary War. He served bravely, ably. Washington said, you know, at the end of this, we come out of this alive. I've decided that your Margaret can move to Mount Vernon and live with you. And then at the end of the war, when they returned to Mount Vernon, and this information is on the official Mount Vernon website, George Washington changed his mind. He said, I changed my mind. Margaret cannot come and live with you. And so records at Mount Vernon indicate that William Lee lived a good long time, and he lived it alone without the company of the woman he loved. And so, that story always stuck with me. I always thought, you know, I can see the prospect of being with someone you love who loves you back. I can see that being an incentive to get you through a dangerous situation like a war. And then at the end of that, to be told, no, it's not going to happen. It's not as simple as her wanting to be with you and you wanting to be with her. It's up to me, a third party, and I've decided it's not going to happen. So that always kind of stuck with me. And the other aspect of the story is more personal. We can trace, and by we, I mean my family, my siblings, cousins, and I, we can trace our line back to a couple named Sam and Iris Harris, who were both enslaved people who found each other after emancipation and married and started the line that, you know, eventually came down to me. And, you know, I have a picture of them that I keep on my desk. We have a Facebook group, our family, that's named after this couple. But at the same time, it's kind of haunted by questions, you know, gaps in the family narrative. As with a lot of African Americans, once you go past 1870, the first census in which we had names, it's really hard, you know, to go back beyond that. So, but I began to wonder about Sam and Iris Harris. I began to wonder, what about their parents and their parents before them? And what were the circumstances of their coming together? Because I know they came together in enslavement. And I don't have that information. So the novel kind of gives me the opportunity to imagine lives of my ancestors or anybody's ancestors, really, who came together in those circumstances. So a lot of the novel arises from my imagining that.
And do we know why Washington changed his mind?
There's some speculation that, and of course, this is speculation. I don't know how true it is. There's some speculation that Washington's wife, Martha, did not like Margaret Thomas and didn't want her on the grounds, but I don't know if that's true.
Well, it's horrible to start with, but also there's a flavor of that in your book. I want to be careful not to give spoilers either.
It's tough.
There's a Green's wife has sort of this power to determine people's lives and the courses of their lives based on what seems like whim, not necessarily on fact, but with. Right. Tremendous consequences. So that gets replicated and shown. So you named these two of the characters, William and Margaret, which I thought was a tremendous honor of that story that you just told from real life. And William is who starts us off. How did you decide to have William start us off?
Well, it's interesting. Initially, I envisioned the entire novel as being told by William. So that's actually why William starts it off. Initially, I'm just thinking I'm going to tell William's story. And as he begins to talk and reflect on other relationships he has, I know he has this love relationship with this woman named Margaret. I know he has a really strong fraternal bond, another kind of love with this man named Cato. And at some point in the writing, I guess, these other voices began to present themselves in their own voices. And I thought that might be interesting to tell the story from different points of view, because on some level, the whole novel is about storytelling and storytelling as resistance and who gets to tell the story and all of that. So I thought, you know, it might be interesting. It made it trickier to write.
I bet.
For sure. But these characters were so insistent, you know, and I thought, you know, let's see what it looks like, at least from their point of view. And if it works out, we'll keep it. That's how that began. So William, I began with William because I actually began with William. There were no other characters when I started, no other narrators for sure.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how you managed all of these voices? Because you have five people, mm-hmm. two men, two women, and a man child, a 15-year-old named Xander, who's going to be everybody's favorite. Who
yeah, probably. Probably.
There is nothing not to love about Xander.
Yeah.
Then you have the omniscient narrator.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's also a, I don't want to know, maybe I'll call it a conspicuous absence of narration from any of the white people who are in the book.
Right.
But you have these thoughts. So,
well, there's the there's the preacher too. The preacher, Preacher Ransom.
Oh, right. That's right. That's right. Preacher Ransom. Yeah. I wonder how you sort of created in your mind a taxonomy for how to distinguish the voices, the two men from each other, for example. How did you keep that? Because even if their names are at the beginning of the chapter, that's really not enough for the reader, right? You know.
Yeah.
You can't expect a reader to remember that through. So you have to sort of really assert these different personalities. And what are some of the distinctions that you came up with?
Yeah, well, I created what I call a profile for each character, which is just pages and pages, right? Where I ask them questions, what they were afraid of, what's their earliest memory, what is their fondest hope, you know, all of those kinds of things. And that helped me to distinguish them just in terms of personality. For example, Cato is much more philosophical and thoughtful than William. He wants to think about it from every angle. He wants to maybe talk to some people. And he's also very spiritual. He's kind of a faith-based guy. And William absolutely is not. He has very little patience for talk of spirit and holiness and God. And so he just wants to do. He just wants to do. So once I knew that, that helped me to shape the language to reflect that kind of personality. And then finally, Cato has had contact with literacy. He's been read to as a child. So his vocabulary is different. His way of describing things is different. And because of that distinction, I could, you know, have distinctions in the language. For example, a lot of the spirituality is based on a belief in seven words. And so one of the things that Cato says when he's really full of meaning and commitment, he says, "I swear it on my seven words," right? And that's something William would never say because, you know, that's just all hogwash. He doesn't really want to hear about that. And similarly with the women. The women narrators are Margaret and Pandora. And Pandora is a woman who Cato gradually falls in love with, and maybe about the middle portion of the book. And like Cato, one of the things they have in common is that Pandora has also been exposed to literacy. She had many fairy tales read in her presence when she was a child. And the language of those fairy tales, she calls them ever after stories. And so the language of the ever after stories influences how she describes things and also how she interacts with the world, right? So so sort of building these dossiers, these profiles really helped me.
Yeah, I love that you call it a dossier because that's really what it is. And every choice, it's not conspicuously deliberate, but there's resonance in every choice. So her ever after, which I see also as what she has to offer, right? Her knowledge of these stories is something, is a gift she is able to offer at crucial moments.
Yes.
But there are stories about a fantasy of a sort of perfect life, which is in stark contrast to her reality. And then Cato's exposure is to talk a little bit about the book, because that's a really interesting thing. Of all the things you could have chosen for him to have learned about, what was this book?
As a child, the book that was read to him is an actual book called The Rules of Civility. And The Rules of Civility was sort of almost like a gentleman's guidebook of that period. And it's a book that George Washington absolutely swore by, right? So, and of course, the paradoxes, the hypocrisy, you know, how to be a gentleman, how to be honorable, is not lost on Cato, because the man who is his captain is anything but honorable. So at one point he says, you know, civility, I marvel at the notion, because, you know, it's almost as fantastic as Pandora's ever after tales, this world in which men comport themselves with honor and kindness and civility.
And are concerned with the minutiae of it too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Rules of civility.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got details about like how one should chew one's food in the company of others. And, you know, like you say, minutiae, you know, that's how he was exposed to letters and reading and writing.
Well, there's a question in the chat which also speaks to something which struck me right away about the book and ties into this question, this greater subject of how you chose who gets to narrate and who doesn't. And the one of the things, aside from the arresting and horrifying opening scene of the novel, is the language we're introduced to as readers right away, in which there are two kinds of people. There are the stolen and there are the thieves. And I just found myself, I was so convinced of its authenticity. I was like, did I miss reading something where people do this? And the one of the audiences asked, how did you come to use stolen and thieves, which just is like a paradigm shifter right away. But tell us about that.
Well, I'm so fascinated with language, right? I mean, you know, so are you, right? It's like people who read and write, that's it's unavoidable. So in many respects, the novel is a reflection on language. And just a couple ideas. One, Richard Wright described language as a battle over the nature of reality between Black people and white people, and that it played itself out in language. And then Baldwin has this wonderful reflection on language, and he says, the root function of language is to control the universe by describing it, right? And so those two reflections have really never been far from me as I engage in this practice. And so I thought, how would my characters push back against control of their universe? And one way they would do it would be through description. And so I thought that these characters, and I believe that people who lived during this period, enslaved people, had no illusions about the moral or the lack of morality of their captors, right? And then also I've got this idea that the enslaved people talk one way when they are alone, they talk another way in the presence of their captors. So, you know, the novel begins, all of us have two tongues. So in the tongue of the enslaved people, they see themselves as victims of theft. Their very humanity has been stolen. And who steals? Thieves, right? So it really came from that.
It was so empowering. It felt like one of the earliest assertions of their sense of their own humanity, that of this group of people, that they would be able to name their circumstance accurately and not bow to the pressure of this supposed reality around them. Which reminds me of another story you've told that figures into this book, which is, well, so white people don't get to talk in this book. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to ideas about reclaiming history and who owns the narrative. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, about what it means to make that choice?
Sure.
You can tell the Thomas Jefferson story too.
Thomas Jefferson story. Oh, maybe we're talking about Notes on the State of Virginia.
Yes, I was.
Yeah. Okay. So Jefferson writes in Notes on the State of Virginia that Black people are incapable of genuine romantic attachment, that it's not something that is within their capacity to experience, and that they're only aroused by animal appetites. And that's Jefferson's language. And that, of course, is intended to enable slaveholders to justify breaking up families, breaking up couples, because he's essentially saying, hey, don't worry about it. It's not real with them, right? So if you see a woman wailing over her child that you've torn from her arms, he even has language in there in which he says it's soon forgotten. She'll forget it very quickly. So one of the things I wanted to push back against was this idea that, you know, Black people don't love, right? They don't long for each other, that their hearts don't speak to each other. So that had to be one of the governing impulses in the book. And then also—
This book is full of love. This book is full of love and all of its incarnations.
Right. All kinds of love, right. Yeah. And I guess, so there's a part in there, William makes a couple of comments on storytelling, which I think are sort of meta comments as far as the novel. At one point, he and Cato need to safeguard themselves in a dangerous situation. And William says to Cato, we can shape this. It's all in the telling, right? And part of their telling is to convince their captors that they thought of this idea, right? That the way they're seeing things is an original idea, when it's really the idea of the stolen. And the other thing he says to Cato is, you know, what's the worst thing that a thief can say to you? It's, let me tell you a story. You hear those words, just run.
So get out.
Get out, right. So
get out.
Right. And so that's why the characters in the book who aren't Black don't get to tell any stories. They never get to say, this is our version of events. What happened was none of that.
Yeah, there's a quote from Pauli Marshall once. I have to paraphrase it because I won't remember it exactly. And she said something like, once you see yourself truthfully depicted on the page, you have a sense of your right to be in the world. Like, that is the power of language.
Right, right. Yeah, and also, you know, one of the things that I tried to get is that, you know, these are intellectually hungry people. And they're not exposed to a lot of information, right? So there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of philosophy, right? And all of these characters, or most of them at least in my mind, are philosophers. And I'm kind of pushing back against this idea. Usually when we see culturally rich African-American philosophy, it's described as folklore. It's always folklore, it's folk wisdom, right? And I'm like, oh yeah, but it's also philosophy. It's deeply held and deeply considered and deeply felt speculations about the nature of the cosmos and the role of people in that cosmos. So I wanted the characters to have conversations about that as well.
We have to talk a little bit about the violence and violation, how you rendered the horrors of their life experience. And I just want to ask, there are a couple of things. First of all, it operates on so many levels, even in the kind of the cruel irony of the name of one of the plantations, Placid Hall.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
To the episode with the chamber pot, to practices of torture that I had to look up because I thought, did Jabari is so nice. Did he come up with this? And at least in one instance, one of the ones I looked up was historically accurate. Yeah. So I wondered how you navigated that, both sort of in terms of creating it, determining how much was enough, and then like not psychically wounding yourself just by dealing with it.
Yeah, sure. No, those are great questions. The characters ultimately transcend a number of horrible things. Ultimately, the book is about the triumph of love over brutality. And I thought it would be really important to depict that brutality in some detail, to give readers some sense of what the characters were up against and what they had to overcome. So I did a lot of research. I mean, I reread Douglass's three memoirs. I read a lot of narratives of enslaved people. I read a really good essay on George Washington's plantation and his relationship to the people he stole. And I also read Henry Wiencheck has this wonderful book called An Imperfect God. It's mostly about the relationship between Washington and his enslaved people. So what I did was I sort of, you know, made notes about, like you say, I think every incident of brutality in the book is inspired by a real life incident, right? So I just took those real life incidents and then, you know, applied my imagination to them, changed some details sometimes. The opening, for example, I didn't even change the name of the man, right? Mm-hmm. He's an actual person that actually happened. So it's easy to accumulate bunches of those, right? Mm-hmm. And so in my original draft, I mean, it was even more challenging as a reader. And I'm really grateful to my editor. My editor was Dawn Davis, who's, you know, a legendary African-American woman editor who edited The Known World, Edward P. Jones's book. She edited Yellow Wife by Sadiqua Johnson. So she really knows this material at least as well as I do, right? So one of the things we went back and forth on was how much brutality do we want to depict? You know, how far apart do we want it spaced? You know, all of these things. And we basically arrived at a point where we thought, okay, the horror is sufficient. Now let's talk about overcoming that horror. As for its effect on me, you know, it wasn't particularly upsetting or challenging this time around. I say this time around because a lot of this material I've spent time with before. When I wrote my book, The N-Word, many years ago, I spent just day after day immersed in hateful material. And it was really challenging. It was really hard on me emotionally. But I think it prepared me for doing this book, right? So that a lot of this stuff I'm not reading for the first time. I'm rereading, right? Uh-huh. And so, and then also I wrote the book in like, you know, stretches over periods of time, in which I put it aside to work on other projects that I had under contract. You know how that is. And I think that was really useful and helpful because I could walk mm-hmm. away from it for a little bit and kind of, you know.
Right. And go to one of your children's books.
There you go.
That's my baby love.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I also want to talk about magic and spirituality, which are big proponents, and a lot of it you have made up.
Yes, yes.
I think people would be interested to know about the big spiritual practice you made up, but also I really want you to talk about magic and how you decided, like, how much magic or ambiguous reality, I don't know what you want to call it.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably better.
That is better.
I've been accepting magic, you know, in conversations, and magic is not really... It's not something I thought about when I was writing it for a couple of reasons. First of all, the spiritual practice I came up with, whispering, is based on this idea that when a stolen child is born, seven adults gather and each whisper one word in the child's ear. And that word is chosen for that child alone. And those seven words become like a mantra. Each person who has seven words says them in the morning when they wake up, they say them at night before they go to bed. They say them to encourage themselves in times of ordeal or challenge. And there's this accompanying belief that if you weren't whispered over as a child, you are doomed to a life of misfortune. You don't have the protection of this consecrated language. So yeah, I made all of that up.
Was that fun? And there are other it seems like that would be fun to have made up a practice like that.
Yeah, because I mean, I really, you know, we talk about decolonize the canon, decolonize your vocabulary. And I thought, well, what if we decolonize our spirituality? What would that look like? Right. So I was just free to imagine it. Right. So I came up with this spiritual practice that these people came from the same continent, but from different places, different backgrounds, different beliefs, but had to come together and come up with something new based on this belief that the language could come out somehow affect materiality, right? So that comes out of that. Other things they do, there's a homegoing ceremony after the death of a person in the book, and they have these interesting things that they do with white cloths. Mm-hmm. I totally made that up. I was just having fun. But yeah, I get lots of questions. People say, well, yeah, what is that based on? What is this right. people? I was like, nah, I just made it up. It's a novel, it's fiction.
Right. But it is historical fiction in a sense, sure, because sure. so much of it is rooted
yeah.
in our tragic history.
Yes.
Before we go to questions, I want to just bring some joy, because there's some joy in here.
It's a lot, and, yeah.
Well, first I want to say one of my favorite characters was the Preacher Ransom, because he navigates a very fine line, and he's able to move freely among the thieves, and they see him as a disseminator of their faith, but he also operates in the world of whispering, and he's a great character. Can't wait to see who plays him in the movie. That too. Let's talk about some of the joy, and let's start with Xander. Xander is joy.
Yes.
And go ahead, talk about Xander. There he is.
Yeah, yeah. The cover art is from panel number 4 of Jacob Lawrence's Harriet Tubman series, which is a series of panels the great artist did about Harriet Tubman. And I was always struck by this particular panel because it's all joy. It's joy in the midst of horrible stuff, right? And so this, I saw this exuberance that he depicted as resistance. And so I actually printed out a copy of that painting. You see a small detail of it on the book, and on the back inside jacket flap, you can see the entire painting. So this is a detail. And I kept it on my desk to sort of motivate me, to remind myself that, you know, in the midst of all of this, you got people turning cartwheels and backflips. And that is the character of Xander. He's He's 15 or 16 years old. He's a man child. He's fleet of foot. He's athletic. He's probably the fastest person among the stolen on the plantation. And he believes that he is descendant from a group of flying Africans, people who could fly. So when he hears mention of angels in the Christian Bible, he says, of course, those are the flying Africans. They just have a different name for them, right? So a lot of his discussion, a lot of his interest is about flight, right? And so you asked me earlier about magic. One of the other characters is named Swing Low. And the interesting thing is a lot of people have interpreted Swing Low as a supernatural character. And that is certainly not my intention. Swing Low is inspired by Harriet Tubman. And, you know, when I think about Harriet Tubman, I always think Harriet Tubman was the original superhero. She did things that seem impossible, that are actually impossible to explain, right? Today, we just don't have a rational explanation for all the things she was able to do. So I imagine an agent, a liberation agent, who operated much like Harriet Tubman did, but in those spaces where we never see Harriet Tubman, we know what the consequences were. We know what her accomplishments were. We seldom know, you know, how she got from A to B to C. So Swing Low is a character in which I get to imagine those things. And Swing Low is seen as a supernatural character by a lot of the, well, actually by the stolen and the thieves, because they believe that there has to be a supernatural explanation for somebody who can do the things she does.
Oh, that's so interesting. What else reminds you? Oh, let's talk a little bit about your writing practice, because first of all, you're just writing every kind of, you write in every genre.
Yeah.
You must be writing all the time.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about your process, your practice?
Sure. Yeah. I'm writing all the time. I'm never not writing. I don't have any hobbies. It's just writing. That's what I do. It's very fulfilling to me. It's work, but it's joyful work. And I'm grateful to be able to do this work. And Muriel Rukeyser has this wonderful quote where she's, I'm paraphrasing. She says, you know, the universe is not made of atoms. It's made of stories, right? And I'm like, yes, right? So, and I'm one of those people who's blessed or burdened, however you want to look at it, with stories. I'm seldom not thinking of a story or hearing a story or poem. And I have enough discipline, fortunately, that I respond quickly and write them down. So for example, the first line of Yonder is, all of us have two tongues. And that line came to me in 2008 when I was walking down the street in Champaign, Illinois. And I had my little Moleskine notebook in my back pocket. And as soon as it came to me, I just stopped, wrote it in my notebook and put it back in my pocket. So I do a lot of that. Two other things, that I'm never working on just one thing. I'm always working on multiple projects, and I just kind of go back and forth. And I write out of sequence. Once I established who the narrators were, for example, in Yonder, early on, Pandora has this monologue where she talks about flies and how much she hates flies, right? And so when that came to me, you know, I sat down and immediately wrote it down, and I had no idea where it was going to go in the novel. I just knew it would, you know, it's like, oh, Pandora's talking to me. Let me get this down. But I didn't have context for it yet, but I was confident that I would. I think it's more important to listen and get it down and worry about where it fits later. So I do a lot of that. If it comes to me, I just try to make sure I get it down somewhere on something, on some surface.
You quoted a mutual friend of ours, the novelist, Matt Johnson, Philadelphia guy,
yes,
who said he wants to write, his goal is to write literary fiction that moves. And
yes,
I would say Yonder is literary fiction that moves.
Oh, good.
Is that genre, that idea of the genre appeals to you, Matt's?
Yeah, I mean, Matt said that in an interview at some point. He may not even remember when he said, but again, I wrote it down immediately. I said, yeah, Matt, that's it. That's it right there. Yeah, I mean, that's what I aim to do. I mean, I wanted to satisfy whatever my expectations are about quote unquote literary fiction, you know, attention to language, attention to, you know, detail and in-depth characterization. At the same time, I think it's Francine Prose who talked about writing as if you are in mortal terror of boring your reader to death. Right? So I want to pay attention to all the things that fascinate me in terms of language and detail and characterization. But at the same time, I want the reader to keep going. I don't want them to put it down. That's the motion part. Yeah, so when Matt said that, I was like, yeah, he's onto something there.
So let's turn to some questions. And we spoke to two questions that came up in the beginning about using the term stolen and thieves and writing through the heinous treatment of the stolen. And now we have a question where the audience member says, yonder is an antiquated Southern word. There's something aspirational about it, that something is near and you see it or almost see it. Can you talk about its significance?
Sure. This is interesting because I'm not real good with titles. I don't have a history of coming up with titles for my book. Sometimes I just, like, for example, this book was called Untitled Fiction Project on my computer. And usually I kind of go to the editor and say, I have no idea what to call this book, and I'm really open to suggestion. But this was a rare instance in which, you know, it was clear to me that the book was going to be called Yonder, and I was able to call it that about halfway through. I think the comment from the questioner is sort of spot on in terms of the aspirational quality of the word. First of all, I'm really into the way words sound, and I really like the sound of the word yonder. It feels good to me. It has a good mouth feel. And so part of the appeal was that. Then there's African-American spiritual, which the soloist repeats, going up yonder. I'm going up yonder, right? And so it's just, the whole thing is like a riff on yonder. And that influenced me as well. And also the dual nature of much of the language of enslaved people, like, swing low, sweet chair, a steal away, for example, right? And the thief can say, oh, they're singing about stealing away to Jesus. Isn't that sweet? They're so devout. And they're really talking about heading to Canada, right? So mm-hmm. so yonder has that effect as well. And then I like the philosophical aspect of it. It's when characters, their knowledge of what is beyond the plantation's border is so limited, and they know it. So they're constantly wondering, what's on the other side of that fence? What's over yonder? And they can have these conversations where they speculate about that. It's a really good multi-purpose word for all of the reasons that we've identified.
Right. And it also, yonder is a subjective measurement depending on who's speaking and in the context. Right. So yonder can be 5 feet away.
Right.
Two.
Right. Right.
And then here's another question. How do you see the book fitting into the tradition of your literary forebears? And in addition, have you read Walter Mosley's 47, and was it an inspiration in any way?
I'm not familiar with Walter Mosley's 47, but I have read many Walter Mosley books, and I'm a great admirer. 47 is another one that I'll have to read and will probably love. I'm continually dazzled by, I'm trying to think if I've ever read anything by Walter Mosley that didn't dazzle me. Probably not. Well, how does it fit into the literary tradition? You know, in my best moments, in my most ambitious moments, I envision everything I write, number one, and being in conversation with each other, that all the books are in conversation with each other. If I'm fortunate, they're also in conversation with my literary ancestors. So I believe so much in ancestors. They're thanked in all the acknowledgments of my books. That's the closest thing to a spiritual practice I have, in my biological ancestors, my spiritual ancestors, and certainly my intellectual and literary ancestors. I hope that the book is a reflection of my love and admiration and gratitude for all of those predecessors. And I hope it fits into any of those books that address or meditate on the same subjects that I'm writing about, such as liberation, faith, love, family, betrayal, all those things. Mm-hmm. All the things, as they say.
All the things. Here's another question. I haven't yet read your book, but I'm curious how you managed such complex themes and characters in a book less than 300 pages. Was your initial manuscript longer before publication?
It's a great question. There was one tiny, tiny passage that I took out. So maybe just a few pages longer. I am mindful that there was one passage. I may have taken it out even before the editor saw it. I'm not sure. It just didn't fit. I don't have an ambition to write like long novels. I wanted it to be an epic novel. I wanted it to have an epic sweep, but I didn't necessarily want it to have epic bulk. I admire those kinds of novels as a reader. I have less admiration for them as a writer because I'm just really averse to bloat. And I want it to be lean, and I want it to be precise and elegant And I'm just, I'm super sensitive to the other demands on the reader's time. And I want them, oh, I could watch television or I could read Jabari's book. I want them to choose the book, right? I'm mindful of that. So, I mean, it's not to say there isn't a fat book in my future, but it would almost have to be an accident. It would almost have to be, it would almost have to be, I couldn't stop writing and it just got bigger and bigger. My goal is to keep it concise.
Well, I wonder if it sort of the triumph of the book is how complex it is in that short space, because I can tell you, audience member who asked this question, that the book is not overpacked. It's not like a suitcase that's been packed too tight. It's not airless. It's not overly dense. All of these complex themes are dealt with, but with fluidity and with motion. If you haven't ordered your book yet, go order your book.
Please do.
But it really does move along. You just mentioned the word love, and I want to talk a little bit about love too, in that you have called yourself a romantic. What does that mean to you?
I'm fascinated by love relationships and couples just in general. Like, I always read the wedding section. I'm that guy. I always read the wedding section. I read any article about couples. I'm less interested in celebrity couples unless they seem, you know, like oddly put together and like, how did they get together? But with regular people, I'm really fascinated. I always kind of want to know how they met and what were the circumstances. I'm just kind of drawn to that kind of thing. And part of it is love is a family tradition. You know, my parents were married for 70 years, right? They're, 70 years. Both sets of grandparents were married over 50 years. And my wife and I have been married over 35 years, right? So it's like, I've kind of been—
You come by it honestly. You come by
yes, it yes, romantic. Yes, yes. I'm very fortunate in that. I mean, I realize that's not everyone's experience and I don't want to dismiss the import of anyone's experience, but that has been my experience, right? And I'm grateful for it. And it has a way of influencing any of the work that I do.
Here's another comment. I wonder if your sensitivity to bloat is also in part because you're first off a poet.
Oh, definitely. Great question. Yeah, totally. In poetry, you know, every word must be earned. Every word must be justified. And there's no question that plays a big part in the other genres in which I write. Great question. Yes, yeah, spot on. Yeah. I should have said that. Yes, my early publications were all poetry. And I think that trickles down is a mild way of putting it. But yeah, it's definitely an influence. Yeah.
I teach creative nonfiction writing, and I can tell when the student who comes into my room is a poet.
Yeah, me too, yes.
This person also goes on to say, they've read the book. I loved that the book moved so beautifully, but was very condensed. Agree with Lisa's description of being not airless, by the way.
Good. I appreciate that.
You brought us oxygen. What else have I missed? Any last questions? Lovely audience. We have a couple more minutes. I guess another theme that was in there, which is resonant to me, is that sanity there's sanity and insanity in this book. It's not just violence. It's not just cruelty, but it strikes me as insanity, right? And that there are also people, at least one I can think of among the stolen, who has lost his sanity. Cupid. I don't know if I'm not supposed.
Oh, that's interesting because I thought you were going to say Double Sam.
Oh, he's I don't know. That different. Just seems like a coping mechanism.
Well, could be. Yeah. I mean, there had to be mental illness, and then there also had to be feigned mental illness, like in which Edward P. Jones does so brilliantly in The Known World. That's another form of resistance. We talk about broken tools. We talk about running away. What about just checking out, right? And so that's an aspect too. And then also among the thieves too. I mean, the chief thief, Cannonball Green, actually believes that he's an expert on the behavior of the people he has. He thinks that when he sees them, he's seeing them as they are, when in fact he never is. But it's so, you know, And
he's taking notes and doing his study and sort of sees fame and fortune in his future for his astute observations.
Yes. And he's never seen the real article, right? And then his wife is a whole nother story, right? Yeah. So yeah, they're unquestionably different levels of mental stability in this world.
Yes. Well put. Jabari, we've come to the end of our time, and I want to thank you.
Oh, it's been wonderful.
This evening, it was great to see you and speak with you about this beautiful novel you've written, Yonder.
Thank you, Lisa. I really appreciate the questions and your company and the company of the audience. So yeah, I'm very happy to be here. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.